Very good morning to everyone. Our first case this morning is number 052495, Berger and Laxton against AXA Network, LLC. Mr. Rose.
Police Court. My name's Josh Rose, and I represent a certified class of insurance agents whom defendant discharged from a statutory employee status called full-time life insurance salesperson, or FTLIS, in one or more years from 1999 through the present. Now, I'd like to begin with an important factual point. The defendant in this case has never announced an employee classification role for the FTLIS status. It would apply for more than 1 year. The document that's talked about much in the briefs is called AIG 98-5. It appears at the page 310 of the appendix. It does not announce a policy of replacing the FTLIS test for more than a year. It's entitled, its subject line on the heading is the PC requirements outlined will be used to determine the status of an agent for tax and benefits purposes during 1999. It didn't announce the policy in 98, which had the inevitable effect of discharging plaintiffs from the status on January 1st of each subsequent year. The policy lasted for only 1 year. Every year it announces a benefits policy. It announces qualification rules. We have something like 25 years or 30 years worth of these bulletins in the appendix. There's one every year. It's a one-year policy. It's not a permanent policy. So every year since 1999, our position is that the defendant has violated ERISA on January 1st of the following year by discharging the plaintiffs from the employment classification called statutory employee or full-time life insurance salesperson. Now, the ruling below on accrual.
So let me just go back so we can make your position crystal clear. If the policy had been consistent every year and there had been no changes to the policy, you would be making a different argument, or your argument would not hold quite the weight that it holds now. Because if the policy change was in 99 and it was clearly defined what the goals were, and it was the same thing each year, would it still be a violation?
Perhaps if they had issued a bulletin in 1998 that said forevermore we will use production requirements instead of the tax code rules for classifying people as FICA employees. Perhaps if they'd said that, there would be a different argument as to whether the announcement or the act of actually discharging them is what is a discharge in violation of Section 510. But we don't even need to go there, at least for purposes of whether there's any class left. We don't need to go there because these bulletins are all clearly just one-year policies. None of them last for more than a year. So contrary to the ruling below, we've never argued that the ruling below actually says a denial of benefits is what our argument is. That's simply incorrect. We've never argued that. It's the discharge from FTLIS status. We actually had a motion to dismiss on the question of whether we were really claiming benefits. We have never claimed benefits. We've claimed that it's the discharge from this status, from this employment condition, this privilege of employment, that is the violation of 510. So when does the violation happen? It happens under the statute when the defendant discharges, fines, suspends, expels, disciplines, or discriminates for the purposes of interfering with benefits eligibility. January 1st of every year, the plaintiffs are discharged from statutory employee status. It happens every year. It's a serial violation. It's not a continuing violation. It's not a policy whose effects are felt later. It's a violation that happens once a year on January 1st when they make this classification decision. So I think on accrual, to use Judge Easterbrook's analogy from the Palmer case that we cite in our brief, the time the plaintiffs get punched in the nose is the time they're discharged. The statute prohibits discharge. It's the act of reclassifying them. It's January 1st of each year. That's when the violation occurs. And so whether the limitations period is 2 years or 5 years, whether the claim accrues on the issuance of the bulletin or on the act itself, we still have a class for all agents starting in January 7th, 2001, 2 years before this was sitting at the worst-case scenario. We still have a class. This court buys the accrual rule. And I think it's crystal clear that the discharge is the event that causes accrual. And the announcement of policy, we cite the Cata case for this. Even if they did announce a policy that's conditional that might happen, they have a history of occasionally changing their benefits things, not consistently, but in October 2003, for example, we have something at 334 of the appendix where they did change their policy. It's a conditional rule. You don't know what's going to happen until it happens. When you get discharged, that's when the violation occurs. The next point I'd like to discuss is what is an adverse action protected by Section 510. The court below said that the discharge from statutory employee status, although she didn't use those words, but she said we had not alleged an adverse action that's sufficient to violate 510. She seemed to think we were only talking about the announcement of the policy in 1998 and not the discharge itself. Both parties cite a case called Deeming versus American Standard, which certainly is the rule for what is an adverse action that violates Section 510. I think Deeming is quite on point. The holding in Deeming, there was a group of people who worked at a plant, I think in Indianapolis. The plant was closed. The people had a collective bargaining agreement, which gave them something called creep rights. Creep rights give you a right to accrue service pension credits during time periods when you're not working but you're on layoff status. The employer made a decision to put them on terminated status rather than layoff status. This court held that that difference in status, that difference in classification, was an adverse employment action sufficient to state a 510 claim. And on that basis, the relief of giving this creep benefit for an extra year was upheld. There's very little difference here. We have statutory employee status, which gives you a right to participate in the benefits plans here. It's clearly a condition of employment. It's clearly not something that's given by the plan. It's given by the employer. It's actually an IRS rule. The employer has chosen to use a production credit rule instead of an IRS rule. That's really a question on pretext for the merits, which the district court didn't address. If this court cares to address it, we can discuss it. But the point is that the use of the production credit rule is an employment classification. It's an adverse action. Section 510 protects the status of being a full-time life insurance salesman because that's the status that lets you participate in an ERISA plan. By the terms of the plan, you can only participate if you're a full-time life insurance salesman. By the terms of the IRS code, they get the tax advantage because you're a FICA employee. There's a provision of the tax code that we cite in the briefs that defines employee for purposes of Section 401 of the code, which gives you the tax advantage under ERISA. For that purpose, you're an employee. If you're a FICA employee, a full-time life insurance salesman is a kind of FICA employee that is not a common law employee. The court below said they were independent contractors before, they're independent contractors after. She's quite right. They were. They are. They're always independent contractors. That status wasn't affected. What's affected is the classification for benefits purposes, for FICA purposes, which is the full-time life insurance salesman classification. Just as the layoff versus terminated classification is protected, so too the full-time benefits classification is protected. We think it was clear error to hold otherwise. Every court that's considered the issue, for example, the Supreme Court in Intermodal, some employees were moved from a subsidiary of the employer, which was a railroad company, to a contractor that was not a railroad company. And under the railroad benefits rules, the contractor was not obliged to give them as generous a pension or welfare benefits plan. The Supreme Court held that that change in status, even though they were doing the same work in the same place for essentially the same people, that change in status was enough to state a claim for 510 because it impacted the benefits. If it was done for the purpose of benefits, it violates 510. We've already discussed Deeming. We have the 11th Circuit case of Seaman versus Arvida Real Estate. Here we have another species of statutory employee, which are called real estate salespeople. There's a special provision of the tax code that we cite in the brief. 26 U.S.C. 3508B1C. They were, by that section of the code, if you change the contract to say that you are an employee, then you're an employee. If you change the contract to say you're not an employee, you're not an employee. So that change in status, according to the 11th Circuit, was sufficient to state a claim of violation of 510 if they could prove the claim factually. On remand, they didn't prove it factually, but that's another issue. The status that is protected by 510 is the classification as full-time life insurance salesman. And the analogy, I think, is clear. We also have the Gitlis case cited in the brief. These were also salespeople. They were considered common law employees. They were changed to common law independent contractors. Once again, it's that change in status. They're still doing the same work for the same people. Their basic rate of pay and so forth isn't affected, but their benefit status has changed. That's the status that's protected by ERISA. Every court has gone that way. Defendant's got no cases to support its argument that the rule is otherwise. The next issue the district court erred on, in our view, is the choice of law question. The district court held that people living in Illinois, worked in Illinois for defendant's office in Illinois, worked their whole careers there, they were paid in Illinois, they signed up for work, they signed their contracts in Illinois, that their claims for discharge from employment in Illinois should be governed by a New York statute of limitations. If this were not a class action, that ruling would be plainly ludicrous. There is no New York connection except the defendant has his home office in New York.
Can we go back to that Gitlis and that Seaman case? Because one of the arguments your opposing counsel makes in looking at what the district court said about it, the court said those cases were really materially different from the situation here. What's your comment as to the applicability of those cases?
Well, probably the factually closest case is the Deeming case. Gitlis involved an actual change from common law employee status to common law independent contractor status because they were called business development attachés in that case. It's not a special category recognized by the tax code. So we don't have the statutory employee twist there. But they did reclassify the job in order to take away the benefits, which is the same thing that ACSA has done here. Reclassify the job to take away the benefits. That's exactly what ERISA 510 is meant to protect against. I don't see a distinction. These cases involve various factual twists. The district court said that there was no discharge here, but she didn't address the question of what a discharge from statutory employee status is if it's not a discharge. I don't know why she didn't address it, but I don't think there's a distinction there.
Thank you.
Now, on the choice of law point, the district court seems to have simply made a mistake. She ruled as a matter of federal common law that the restatement of conflicts of law should apply. That's an undecided question. This court hasn't decided it. The Supreme Court hasn't decided it. Both courts declined to decide it. I don't think it's necessary to decide here whether it's the restatement rule or the slightly different common law rule in Illinois, because under the facts of this case, both rules have the same result. The court below applied Section 145 of the restatement. Section 145 is general principles for choice of substantive tort law. Section 145 is not the section of the restatement that applies to statutes of limitations. Section 142(2) applies to statutes of limitations, and it has two requirements. First, that the maintenance of the claim would serve no substantial forum interest. And second, that the claim would be barred under the limitation statute of a state with more significant relationship. The court examined only significant relationship. The court did not look at substantial forum interest. We think it's clear there is substantial forum interest here. The plaintiffs lived in Illinois. They worked in Illinois. Bennett had his office in Illinois. At least for these plaintiffs, there's clearly a substantial forum interest. That's enough under Section 142.
But this is a class action, and there are plaintiffs other than the few named plaintiffs from Illinois. Does that change the picture?
I don't think so, because the genesis of the limitations rule comes from sort of the pre-1960 law. The common law rule was that statutes of limitation are procedural. They are a forum rule that's made for the convenience of the forum. It has nothing to do with the substance of the claim itself. But while that distinction has sort of fallen into disuse in the restatement, it's still there in the form of, if you don't have a good reason for not applying forum rules, you do apply forum rules. Because it's only a procedural thing, it doesn't have to be appropriate for each class member. It has to be appropriate for the court. And there's no particular reason not to use it here. This court has said you do borrow state forum law. The defendant is arguing, and we have no objection to using the restatement as federal common law for choice of law. And the restatement rule is quite clear that you
has
only...
Has Illinois used the restatement 142 in analogous circumstances?
No. Illinois uses the traditional rule that statute of limitation is a procedural rule that goes with the court.
So you don't think we're bound by the Illinois rule, that if we're going to import state law, we must import the Illinois rule?
Absolutely. I think under the Toomer case, this court has decided the five-year Illinois statute is the statute for ERISA 510 cases. No one's arguing otherwise. The question is whether the choice of law principles point to Illinois or point to New York. And I think here, under either choice of law principle, it clearly points to Illinois, simply because the most significant relationship test that the court applied is not the test for limitations. The other point we have in the brief is on the merits, and just in closing, I'd like to point out that we do have a rather strong case on the merits. These are all bulletins that say the decision is made for benefits reasons. These people are classified for the purpose of taking away their benefits. That is the purpose that violates Section 510. It's quite understandable if this court simply remands for the district court to decide on the merits, but we do have a large section of the brief devoted to that point, that every piece of evidence in the case points to this rule having been adopted as a benefits rule. There is a case called Egan. The defendant points to as some kind of legal rule. The case was Egan was decided by the First Circuit 2 years after the CEO of the company and the head of a distribution decided to adopt this rule. Egan does not have anything to do with full-time employment, full-time life insurance salesman status, because it was stipulated in that case that the guy was not a full-time life insurance salesman. There's no discussion of it in Egan. Egan is plainly a pretext defendant has come up with for trying to justify what is a benefits rule on its face. On all the memos defendant decided, there's simply no doubt that this is a rule that was adopted for the purpose of taking away benefits. That's the way it's been used. Every bulletin for the last 7 years has said that. And I think if it's remanded, the district court would have a hard time justifying any contrary ruling on the merits. So I suppose I'm done speaking, even though my time isn't quite up.
Well, you're into your rebuttal time now.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rose. We'll hear now from Ms. Ross.
May it please the court. Your Honors, there's a fundamental problem with the plaintiff's argument here, and the problem is that, as this court has repeatedly held, starting in 1990 in the Deming case, in the Toomer case, in Your Honors' McGath case, Section 510 requires an adverse employment action. It requires that an employee be discharged, be fined, be suspended, something that alters the employee-employer relationship. You don't have that here. What you have, as the district court correctly noted, is a change in the method by which agents are determined to be fitless for purposes of benefit and FICA eligibility. Let's step back and take a look at the facts here. Plaintiffs brought this class action on behalf of approximately 5,000 agents of the Equitable. All of those agents were and still are today independent contractors. There has been absolutely no change in their employment status. The only way for an independent contractor to be eligible for an ERISA-governed benefit and for FICA payments is to qualify under a narrow exception of the Internal Revenue Code, which is known as the full-time life insurance salesman exception. Also, we refer to it as FITLIS. That requires that agents be selling primarily life products for one company. In the 1990s, the company became concerned. Up until it announced this new policy in 1998, the method for determining whether an agent was fitless was the honor code. Agents were asked to fill out a questionnaire when they joined the Equitable, stating whether or not they intended to sell Equitable products full time. They answered the questionnaire that they so intended, they were deemed to be fitless, and they were eligible for benefits. Well, the agents obviously were not stupid, and most of the agents, if not all of the agents, signed the questionnaire to say that, yes, they did intend to sell for the Equitable. Well, the insurance industry changed over the years, and agents became able to sell not only for the Equitable, but for other companies as well. And you actually have in the record the plaintiffs admitting that in the 1990s, they received 85 to 90% of their annual commissions from selling other companies' products. But yet they were still able to obtain retirement benefits, health benefits, to participate in the investment plan of the Equitable, even though they were out on the street selling primarily for other companies, if they were selling at all. There is evidence in the record that some of the class members were not even selling. That was not their primary career. All of this culminated in a concern by the Equitable that they had people out there who perhaps wouldn't qualify as fitless under the Internal Revenue Code. And it came at a time when the Equitable was also undergoing severe economic issues. And the Equitable said, we've got to do something about this. So they put their heads together and they devised a policy that said, from now on, you will be eligible to participate in the benefit plans if you sell a certain number of production credits. Now, production credits, Your Honors, is comparable to a dollar. So the 19...
So it's really comparable to a sales quota, isn't it?
It is. That's exactly right, Your Honor. Yeah. So, for instance, when they announced the PC requirement for 1999 and 98.5, they said that in order to qualify for the benefits, you had to sell at least 30,000 PCs, roughly $30,000 worth of life insurance. Now, Your Honors, most of the agents met that. In fact, plaintiffs have stated that approximately 1,200 agents a year did not meet the test. That means that 3,800 agents, assuming 5,000 agents, met the test, not particularly onerous. But more importantly, the agents were in control of their own eligibility. If they chose to sell the required amount, they could participate in the benefit plans. There was no discharge. There was no termination. Sure, plaintiffs state that, well, they were discharged from statutory employee status. Statutory employee status is a fiction of the Internal Revenue Code. It allows, as I said earlier, agents who are not common law employees to participate in the benefit plan. It's a narrow exception. But these agents were independent contractors then, and they were independent contractors even if they didn't qualify. They entered into no new contract. They came in, they did their job just as they had been doing previously. This court has always interpreted Section 510 very narrowly and as requiring an adverse employment action. And I stress the word employment. In the Toomer case, in 1992, the court wrote, Section 510, however, does not protect employees against all employer actions undertaken with an eye toward thwarting the attainment of benefits. Only changes in one's employment status, with those words italicized, cannot stem from benefit-based motivations. You simply
let me just stop you for a minute. If we were to rule against you and find that this reclassification was an adverse employment situation, shouldn't the I want to just get to the statute of limitations issue and when it would begin to run. Shouldn't it run when the agent is reclassified rather than when the policy is circulated?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Your Honor, I know the plaintiffs are doing their darndest to try to argue that this was a repeated new discriminatory act so that they can slot in under this court's holdings in the Reese case and other cases.
And the goals were changed from year to year.
The goals were changed, Your Honor. That is correct. But the policy was announced in 1998. There was a fundamental change in the way that these people were going to be able to qualify for benefits.
So it's your position that an individual plaintiff could only sue when that first policy was articulated, even though the various goals for each year changed in terms of the quota?
Sure, because what is required? In order to have accrual under the toll case, you have to have notice of the unlawful act and and discovery that it applies to you. And that is exactly what these agents had.
But if they had brought the claim before they failed to meet the sales goal, their claim wouldn't be ripe, would it?
It would indeed, Your Honor. ERISA,
it would or would not?
It would. And that is because ERISA is one of the rare statutes that recognizes that you can indeed bring a claim to clarify your right to future benefits. You do not have to wait until the benefits are denied. Your Honor, if you accept plaintiff's argument that the claim arises or accrues every time an agent falls off the wagon, you must accept the effect that that is going to have on plan administration. That means that the company would never have any finality in knowing whether or not its benefit plan decision was going to be subject to legal challenge. The same problem with the choice of laws issue that I will get to in a minute. If you buy the plaintiff's argument, then you're basically accepting the argument that the employer is constantly subject to one of 50 state statute of limitations, and there is no finality. And many courts have recognized that accepting a final statute of limitations period for challenging benefit plan decisions inures to the benefit of the beneficiary, because the uncertainty that corresponds with not having that period expire results in higher administrative costs, it results in litigation reserves, it makes benefits far more costly. The plaintiffs have an additional hurdle, other than the lack of any adverse employment action here, and that is that they have not presented evidence that this method was adopted with an illegitimate motive. This court has recognized that there are two ways to prove the illegitimate motive required under Section 510, and those two ways is set forth in the Cox versus Little versus Cox supermarkets are either the direct method, which the plaintiffs do rely on, or the indirect method, which is basically adopting the McDonnell-Douglas burden shifting. Plaintiffs have waived the indirect method. They chose not to pursue that argument. What they do argue is that they don't need to pursue the indirect circumstantial evidence method because they have direct evidence that this new method of qualifying agents was adopted with an illegitimate means or motive, because they have evidence that the reason behind it was to cut costs. Well, Your Honors, all the way up to the Supreme Court, cutting costs is not an illegitimate basis for making changes to a benefit plan. In 1999, the Supreme Court, in a unanimous decision of Intermodal, stated, we understand that an employer needs flexibility in case economic situations should suffer. This court, in the Little versus Cox supermarket and in the Deming case, recognized that there may be reasons to amend benefit plans that are due to financial straits. So plaintiffs simply do not have direct evidence. If they were to have pursued the indirect evidence method, they would have had to articulate a prima facie case. The equitable would have defeated that by showing its three legitimate reasons for adopting the new method. One, as I stated earlier, their concerns that they were not in compliance with the Internal Revenue Code. Two, their need to cut costs. And three, their concerns that their agents were out there selling for other companies while they were receiving benefits from the equitable, but not primarily selling the equitable products. Plaintiffs simply cannot prove a Section 510 claim. Let me turn to the statute of limitations. Plaintiffs' counsel is correct. This case does present one of first impression as to the choice of law to be applied. But the problem with plaintiff's argument is it's far too much on the surface. He's arguing that simply because you have two plaintiffs bringing this lawsuit who worked at one of Equitable's many agencies across the nation in Illinois, that there is no question, it's a very simple analysis, Illinois law governs. But that's not how the law works. As far up if the Supreme Court in the Reed versus United TransUnion case, recognized the general law that federal courts should apply the forum state statute of limitation, except when it would interfere with the national policies underlying the federal statute at issue. Judge Posner, in the Doe case, adopted that same analysis and reasoning, recognizing that which state statutes of limitation applies is a question of federal law, and that the limitation principles to be applied should be decided in accordance with the policies discernible in or imputable to the federal statute at issue. Obviously, we don't have a diversity case. And we don't have federal statutes like the plaintiff relies on when he cites this court to three other cases that simply adopt the forum state statute of limitations. We have at issue the federal statute of ERISA, a statute whose primary purpose, as stated by the Supreme Court in the Pilot Life case, is to foster uniformity of decisions to help plan fiduciaries predict the legality of proposed actions without necessity of reference to varying state laws. Judge Posner recognized the particular inappropriateness in ERISA cases of simply following the general rule that forum state law applies because of ERISA's sweeping preemption of state law. How should this court address the issue as to what choice of law to apply? There are two elements here. One is two different analyses here. One is to follow the restatement. Now, Judge Bucklow applied Restatement Section 145. That is the restatement regarding the general principle for torts. Perhaps more analogous is Restatement Section 142, which specifically addresses the choice of laws to be applied when you're addressing state statute of limitations. But it really is not a material distinction, because if you look at both of those sections, you see that the test boils down to which is the state that has the most significant relationship to the occurrence and the parties.
Can I just go back for a minute to your earlier argument when you identified the three reasons that the employer wanted this change of policy? The district court really never ruled on the intent of the employer. Did she ever get to that in her?
She did not, Your Honor.
She did not.
She ended her analysis with the finding that there had not been an adverse employment action under Section 510. If you apply the test of the most significant relationship, it's really not that complicated. You have a company whose headquartered and principal place of business is in New York. You have benefit plans that apply to agents nationwide. Plaintiffs had the good fortune, or I should say, counsel had the good fortune to bring this case on behalf of two plaintiffs who lived in Illinois, where the court more recently stated in Section 510 cases when there is no choice of laws issue, and that was specifically stated in the Toomer case, when there is no choice of laws question, you apply the 5-year statute of limitations for retaliatory discharge in Illinois. But you have the benefit plans administered in New York. You have this decision made and implemented in New York. Everything centers on New York. The additional analysis that the court can apply is that the benefit plan itself had a choice of laws provision. No, it did not specifically target the statute of limitations. No benefit plan designer, when they're sitting there and writing what laws are going to apply, is likely to think, well, we should explicitly say that this will apply to the statute of limitations. But you have the plan sponsor, the designer of the benefit plan itself, choosing to have the plan held to the standards of New York law to the extent not preempted by ERISA. The reason the court should enforce the plan's choice of laws provision is it goes right back into the whole congressional balance struck in enacting ERISA. Congress said, we want to have a voluntary system of providing benefits to employees. We can't make this so onerous that employers do the obvious thing of simply saying, we're not going to provide benefits. So Congress said, we're going to let plan sponsors design their own plans, but be careful what you design because we're going to hold you to those standards. In this case, the company said, New York law will govern to the extent it's not preempted by ERISA. This court should adhere to that rule, particularly because it also eliminates the problem that if you don't, you end up with a situation that creates forum shopping, that creates uncertainty, and that creates piecemeal lawsuits, because there will always be somebody who's falling off the wagon, Your Honor, who can bring a lawsuit in Tennessee where the statute of limitations may be 15 years. For all of those reasons, Your Honor, I ask that the district court's opinion be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ross. How much time does Mr. Rose have? Thank you.
Your Honors, Ms. Ross is quite correct. The intermodal case did say a plan sponsor can amend a plan to take away benefits. The Equitable has long had a health plan that makes the health benefits contingent on meeting a production requirement. That's why they've issued these bulletins every year, to state what the production requirement is. It could have amended the retirement and investment plan and the other plans involved here to have a similar provision. It didn't do it. That would have been the right way to do it. It could have gotten away with it. We couldn't have sued him for that. Instead, it decided to change the employment relationship. The FTLS classification is a definition of employee for purposes of ERISA under the tax code. It defines employee to be someone who is a full-time life insurance salesman within the meaning of the FICA statute. That's a change in employment relationship. That's what the defendant changed. That is precisely what ERISA prohibits. A change in the employment relationship designed to interfere with benefits eligibility. The Deeming case is exactly on point, as I said earlier. A change, instead of putting them in terminated status, they put them in layoff status. Same thing here. put them in non-fitless status instead of fitless status for the sole purpose of taking away benefits. There was no other reason for it. If they said so in all their documents, it's on the face of the documents. The first document about this says it is a proposal to, I've forgotten the language, I quote it in the brief, but to disqualify agents from these plans. Every single bulletin announcing it is a bulletin for benefits eligibility. That was the reason for it. On the choice of law question, Ms. Ross cites the Reed case. This court rejected the Reed case as a basis for choice of law. In the Toomer opinion, note one discusses that at great length. I won't go into it here. But clearly, the uniformity interest would be advanced by having a federal statute, but Congress didn't give us one. Under the Hoosier-Cardner rule, which is the genesis of Reed, you borrow a state limitations period. That's what this court has said we should do, and that is the precedent that we've got here. If this court cares to change the precedent, I certainly think it could adopt a federal rule, perhaps the four-year limitations rule that Congress adopted as a catch-all for statutes enacted after 1991. It could be any rule, but that's not the case law we have here. That's not the precedent we've been relying on in bringing these cases. And it would have to be a prospective rule if it were adopted. I don't think it could apply to this case. I see my time is up. If there are any more questions?
I don't think so. Thank you very much, Mr. Rose. And thank you, Ms. Ross. Both of you gave us very fine briefs and a very fine presentation.